Resources to order. It's 1:05, and present day are Representative Wilson, Representative Munoz, Representative Foster, Representative Gardner, Representative Dick, myself, co-chair Seaton, co-chair Feige is out of town and excused, and Representative Kawasaki and Heron are also excused. Today we have, first of all, I want to remind everybody about their cell phones again. The start of a new session, and people are forgetting. Today we'll have an overview from the Department of Natural Resources on oil and gas, the division, and the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. The overview has been scheduled for the Division of Geological Surveys. Will be tentatively rescheduled for Friday, February 4th. On Monday, we'll have an overview on ORMAT technologies, on geothermal development and generation, and also the Department of Natural Resources Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, and the Division of Coastal and Ocean Management. Does any member have anything come before the committee before we get started? Okay, thank you. And Mr. Banks, would you come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And Kevin, I think what we'll do is we'll go ahead and go through your presentation and write down our questions, if that would be the best way, and then we'll get through your presentation and then come back to questions, unless they're just a point of clarification. But any in-depth questions will come back at the end.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That will be wonderful. For the record, my name is Kevin Banks. I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and today I will be giving you something in an overview of what our division does. Just as a couple of points before I begin, you're also going to be hearing from Commissioner Forrester today speaking about the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, and I'd like to make a distinction for you, for those of you that may not be familiar with how our two agencies work and how we are different and how we are the same. And I'm sure Commissioner Forster will also provide you a little bit more clarity in that. Basically, DNR, or the Division of Oil and Gas, is part of the Department of Natural Resources, and we're the landlord of the state lands. And my particular division is responsible for acting in that role with respect to our oil industry here and the leases that they hold on state lands. We have some similar tasks before us at the Division of Oil and Gas, as does the Oil and Gas Conservation Commission with respect to conservation and managing the rights of different leaseholders and owners of the oil and gas in the state. Our focus is on state lands. AOGCC's focus is on all lands within the state. We sometimes act, and I should point out, too, that in that regard, the AOGCC functions in a judicial fashion to adjudicate differences related to ownership controversies and issues related to the conservation of the resource. We at the Department of Natural Resources and Division of Oil and Gas, and I'll get into this more detail later, are also involved with conservation issues. We also are concerned about the economic recovery of our oil and gas resources. We want to make sure that facilities on our land are not duplicated when they don't have to be, just to minimize environmental impact as the lands are developed, and also to make for the lowest cost recovery of our resources. And in that regard, that is in fact how we are different than AOGCC. Sometimes we have to go to the AOGCC just like any other landowner or oil and gas producer and work out differences with respect to ownership and those sorts of things. So we sit before them just as any other party would in the state. So I hope that'll clear it up. I know Commissioner Forrester will do this, will probably touch on those sorts of issues too, and she'll do a much better job than me. I'm so much more articulate. So with that, let's begin. This last year, the division has taken on the task of working on a new strategic plan, and we spent an amazing amount of time framing this mission statement for ourselves. And it's important to realize that in that process we were able to really get a lot of buy-in from members of our staff who thought very carefully about what this means for us. And basically, we are looking for a developing processes within our division and managing our lands in such a way that our lessees and the public can be assured that we are functioning in a way that is accountable, and that our lessees are developing our lands to the maximum benefit of all of us here in Alaska. And one of the things that I think you need to understand about, sometimes I think it's lost on folks, but put yourself in the role of an owner of a shopping mall for a moment. You're the landlord in the shopping mall. You have lessees that own and operate stores within that shopping mall. You may have certain arrangements with those storekeepers as to how much the rent they pay. Maybe even a share of some of their revenue comes to you as the landlord and owner of the shopping mall. Well, that's precisely the same relationship that the Division of Oil and Gas has with our lessees. We're concerned about whether or not the shop owners are taking care of the property and keeping the public spaces around their stores clean, and that folks don't run off with the light bulbs when they leave. You know, all of that is we all deal with, obviously in a much different scale, all of those same issues. And we receive those authorities from statute, mostly through 3805180, which I've listed on this part of our mission elements. We manage oil and gas lands. We manage geothermal lands as well. You'll be hearing about that next week. But to the extent that geothermal is going to be developed on state land, it will be the Division of Oil and Gas that will be unitizing, offering those leases, and permitting the surface activities for those kinds of activities. In fact, Oil and Gas Conservation Commission has a role there too now after last year's change in law. We also are responsible, as I said, we don't want folks messing with our land. So under 3805035, the general state land laws of the state, we're responsible for inspecting activities and facilities on state land with respect to oil and gas. We permit for land use permits and those sorts of things as well. We rely a good deal in our interactions with other divisions in the Department of Natural Resources to conduct those kinds of inspections, to issue those kinds of permits, and we can talk more about that as you wish later. So that gives you an idea of our mission, our mission elements. This slide is kind of a bit of a brag, I have to admit. But what we're saying here is that, and you have to realize just sometimes how important the state is in the oil industry here. If we were a producer, we would be the fourth largest producer in the state. This is the oil that the state owns in the form of royalty. And obviously about an eighth of the production in the state of Alaska comes from state lands. And that, if we were a full participant in the cost and everything else in developing our lands, we would be the fourth largest oil producer in Alaska. So it's a bit of a brag. It's a bit of an expression of data in a certain way to try to illustrate that we do have a very important role here. And it is unique in the United States. There are no other states that command this kind of presence in the oil and gas industry within their boundaries. And it's simply because so much of, nearly all of the oil and gas produced in Alaska is produced on state lands. Our organization looks a little bit like an oil company in terms of the kinds of functions that we have. In no particular order, this org chart shows that we have a staff of folks involved in evaluating the resource so that we can understand the breadth and size of various oil and gas fields when we are asked to offer those up to lease or to unitize leases or to conduct and manage for activities withdrawing oil from our leases. We have folks whose responsibility it is to prepare and administrate leases. We have a permitting staff. We actually have now a crew of people responsible for managing the commercial agreements that we have with all of our lessees with respect to how much is the value of our resource, our oil and gas royalty. These same folks are also responsible for managing our royalty in kind oil and gas program to the extent that we sell royalty oil, and particularly Flint Hills happens to be our biggest and only purchaser of royalty in kind these days. That staff is focused on that. So as you can see, we have a group of people, all of whom you would find in an oil company. Some of our staff have had many years of experience in the oil industry, and we try to meet and match our partners in the oil industry when it comes time to exercise our rights and obligations under the oil and gas leases. We also now have embedded in the division the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. About 4 years ago, by executive order, the PSIO was created to start the process, and we'll speak a little bit more about it, but to get a handle on the industry's capability to manage for its safety, its appropriate and prudent development of our resources without accident or loss of revenue. So, you know, by way of explaining what we do, I thought I'd touch on just a few achievements of the last year for each of the various sections in the division. And each of the slides that you'll see coming up are pretty wordy, so I thought what I would do is simply make one point on each slide, and then you'll get a flavor for what we do. That way I can get through the slide pack fairly quickly and not waste too much of your time today. Division-wide, there are a couple things that we've been doing, and most importantly, as I mentioned earlier, we've started a strategic plan, one that has, in my memory, has never been done for the division. And basically the objective was to create an environment in which we act consciously and not unconsciously when we make decisions. I mean, it is something of a surprise all the time as an organization gets into the routine of its activities that sometimes it loses sight of what we're supposed to be doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just I think all of you can understand that just happens to organizations. So that was the one objective. The second objective, I basically told my staff what I told my kids when they were teenagers. Inspire confidence. You know, act in a way and develop workflows and work processes so that people can be assured that the decisions that we make are properly grounded, fully documented, and will be successful if challenged, and so that people will trust that the Division of Oil and Gas can do the job that it's been assigned to do. So inspire confidence. Those are the two sort of key words that I was after to try to develop an environment in which we all work together in the division.
And before you go on, I wanted to recognize that we've been joined by Committee Member Foster, and also we have Representative Dan Sadler in our audience. And Representative Sadler, we have a committee member on the end that's not going to be here today. If you'd like to join us up at the table, we have room. And Representative Wilson had a question.
I just had a couple questions, and they're real simple ones. PSIO is Petroleum System, what kind of office?
Integrity Office, Petroleum Systems Integrity Office.
Okay, and then who's the deputy director?
The deputy director is Kurt Gibson.
Kurt Gibson, okay, thank you.
And we talked about some of the folks that we have in our division with a lot of industry experience. Kurt Gibson comes to us with about 15 years of experience trading gas and gas pipeline capacity for pipelines, utilities, and producers in the lower 48 before he came back. He's a long-lived Alaskan. He grew up here and came back to work for us.
And Mr. Banks, could you later supply us with the org chart with the personnel that you have in those positions?
I'd be delighted to, and I'll include phone numbers.
It doesn't need
everyone
now, but later on.
I'll do that, and we'll include phone numbers of all of our staff, too. You're welcome to call us if you need to have any questions. Resource evaluation. Now, I'm going to go through each of the sections in the division, and there is actually some order to this. Before you lease oil, before you explore and discover oil, and before oil is produced, you have to figure out what we know about the resource and the potential of the resource, and that's what these folks do for us. They contribute to decision making on with respect to whether or not we're getting the full value of our leases. They are involved in helping us to decide how big units need to be, and I'll explain what that means in a moment. Assist in many other ways, in actually as a consulting organization within the division, but also for our clients, so to speak, outside of the division and throughout government. So I'll make one point on this. The first bullet refers to a study that this team did last year and completed in December, and now are working on the second phase, referring to the Cook Inlet gas supply. This gives us an assessment of the potential reserves in the Cook Inlet over the next many years. And the second part of the study, which will be completed in a month or so, will approach and try to analyze how much that new resource reserve production will cost. So that this is work, the second half of this work, we're working quite closely and together with the Alaska Gas Development Corporation, Mr. Fowski's crew, and to offer them a way of describing the options that will be available to Alaskans with respect to building a bullet line, developing gas resources here in the Cook Inlet, and all of the other potential activities that we might consider in order to make sure that Alaskans get natural gas energy into their homes. Leasing. Once we've determined that we have a resource, we want to lease it to people. Our lease staff is actually involves not just contract administrators for the leases, but it also involves folks whose responsibility, biologists and others, whose responsibility is to document the best interests of the state when we offer land for lease. We have to evaluate the environment, what kinds of federal and state regulations guide development activities, and then these folks will prepare a notice and put on a competitive lease sale. These are sealed bid auctions, and we do a lease sale for every one of our oil and gas lease sale areas in the state once a year. So it's actually quite a brilliant idea that my predecessors came up with. But basically, we offer every acreage of land available for oil and gas development every year and keep churning it. As leases come back to us because they're relinquished by oil companies for whatever reason, as oil companies come up with new ideas and new ways of developing oil and gas, they know, and there's a very predictable way of knowing that in October they can bid on land on the North Slope, in May they can bid on land in the Cook Inlet, and it churns every year. So it's very predictable. It's not done in other places, and all of the acreage is offered each year. Unit administration gets to the point after the leases are sold, and oil and gas has been found. There's a need to delineate an oil field. We don't usually in the division speak of pools and fields so often, like Commissioner Forrester will discuss, but we do talk about units. And what that means is that we combine all of the leases that overlie a potential pool of oil with the notion that each of the lessees within that combination, within that unit, will share in the cost and the benefits of developing it, and that they share in such a way that's fair. This is, you know, the reference to correlative rights. If you saw the movie There Will Be Blood, it avoids the problem of the milkshake that the character in that movie refers to, where his straw reaches into somebody else's lease and sucks the milkshake from his cup. So the idea of unitization is to prevent that from happening, so that if someone on the very edge of an oil field actually does have oil that is contributing to the production of the main field, they will be compensated for production. This is also where we get into minimizing environmental impacts by making sure that the development occurs in an orderly sort of way, that we don't have oil wells on top of each other, that you don't have more facilities than you need. This is actually some of our most sophisticated relationship with the industry occurs at this point, because it involves so much of our division in the engagement. We have to have the resource and geoscientists working on this, our land people with their law background, and the commercial folks are usually engaged in creating these decisions, as we've listed here, to create a unit, to create a participation area which determines how much each lease will participate in the production, and so forth. So this is where we really spin up, and our division works very hard to get these decisions right. Royalty accounting, although we have 95 people and a budget of $14 million, we actually do make quite a bit of money. We brought in $2.2 billion. Roughly half of that goes into the permanent fund under the rules of 50% of the royalty production goes in that. Note, I think it's important to note just how much money is associated with the sale of oil to Flint Hills. So to a certain extent, we've got a lot of eggs in one basket there, and so we are very, very interested in the health and welfare of the Flint Hills refinery.
I recommend Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You just mentioned the fact that about 50% of that goes into the permanent fund, mm-hmm. and how does that relate overall that 25% of the oil revenue goes into the permanent fund?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, by law, I think we've gotten to the point where there had been an automatic sunset provision in the law that dropped us down to 25%. That is, I think, part of the constitutional amendment that created the permanent fund. This body, the legislative body, at some point said, no, we'll make it 50%. That was relaxed when budget issues became an issue, but it automatically flipped back to the 50% rule. Now, the reason I'm struggling here is that, in fact, all oil revenues, taxes and other revenues, may amount to a number where deposits to the permanent fund are only 25% of that by happenstance. I'm not sure if that's true. But the royalty and bonus bids and rents associated with resource development, half of that goes into the permanent fund by law. And that grinds through the Department of Natural Resources in one form or another. We audit our royalty value and agreements and the leases. It shouldn't surprise you that there may be some discussion about how much our oil is worth. In 1977, the same month that Prudhoe Bay began producing oil, the state initiated the ANS royalty litigation that lasted for a very long time, almost 16 years or more. And at the conclusion of that litigation, much of the production from the North Slope was in the question of value for that production with respect to our royalties was resolved in the form of several royalty settlement agreements with our lessees. The settlement agreements define a way of calculating the royalty value. These folks in our audit section make sure that those numbers are correct. Commercial, again, this group is engaged in questions like what is the market value to the extent that we rely on an expression of market value in our lease forms. In terms of exercising the periodic opportunities we have to renegotiate our royalty settlement agreements, staff of economists and petroleum commercial analysts are engaged in doing that kind of work. It's important also to point out, as I mentioned before, with resource evaluation, these are the folks that are working on the cost figures for what it will take to produce gas in the Cook Inlet over the next decade or so, and are a part of that research. People in this particular group are also have been at times seconded to or help work on gas line issues as well for the rest of the department and in cooperation with the Department of Revenue. And finally, we get back to the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office again. Several years ago, 3 years or so years ago, you funded a project called the Gap Analysis. That work is nearly complete. The report has been presented to the governor's resource subcabinet, and they are now preparing recommendations for the governor. The Petroleum Systems Integrity Office was an outgrowth of the failure of the oil transit lines in Prudhoe Bay in 2006, in March and August of 2006, when the big oil spills occurred in Prudhoe Bay, and there was some real concern on the part of the state that corrosion problems were existed in the Prudhoe Bay area and were largely apparently unknown as to the extent. At least that was the impression we were given by the industry, that that the extent of corrosion there was more widespread than folks expected. This agency, or this particular office, was formed to try to solve that problem. And the first step in it was to conduct this gap analysis to find out what kinds of infrastructure and what kinds of jurisdictions within the state oversight, and we're talking everyone from DEC to the Department of Labor, DNR, AOGCC, to the extent that all of these different agencies have some oversight responsibilities for the facilities on the North Slope, for the wells on the North Slope, and the pipelines on the North Slope. Where are the gaps in those jurisdictions, and what kinds of infrastructure isn't getting the kind of oversight that we wanted? So that's what the gap analysis was intended to identify, and also to find out where overlaps occur, so that we can more efficiently provide oversight to the industry.
Representative Wilson?
Sorry. What have you found? I mean, if you're going to go into it at another time, that's fine. But I'm just wondering, since this integrity office has come into being, are you still trying to evaluate, or have you found you've gotten some findings and we know what's going on?
Well, the gap analysis, Representative Wilson, through the chair, is still in the process of completion, so it's not done yet. This same group of folks have responded to certain events that have occurred in the last few years, gas lines that have burst on the North Slope, to try to figure out what are the root causes of those events and to get an assessment of what industry's response to those events are, and what kind of inspection programs the industry is conducting on its own. So we've had some interaction through those kinds of events with the industry, and in fact, we've also occasionally dealt with in the situation with the oil transit lines in the 2006 event. There was a lot of congressional interest in that. This agency, this office, helped in responding to those inquiries as well. And so we're still, it's still a work in progress, and we hope that over the next year or so that we can finally get to a point where our interaction with the industry can be a little bit more formalized, and we can begin to understand more fully what kinds of integrity management, safety oversight, and quality management, quality assurance programs do the companies themselves have. And we would like to make sure that if it's in place, Mr. Company, are you following the plans that you've made? So that's where we're going with it.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really think that probably it's kind of a double-edged sword because of the fact that, first of all, it's lasting longer than they perceived it would to begin with. We're already past the lifetime, the original perceived lifetime. Mm-hmm. So what is the lifetime of the pipeline, and then what is maybe could use better techniques as far as keeping it up and maintaining it and whatnot. So I imagine it's kind of difficult to tell between those two what you're dealing with. Do you want to make a comment on that?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilson, you're right. I mean, I think we have a Mercedes-Benz on the North Slope, but it's an old one. So you have to keep it running by maintaining it and making sure the parts don't fail before you replace them. Feedback and questions. I'll comment a little bit about this. I think my staff would prefer we call this stump the chump, but you'll notice in your packet there are a lot more slides, and this is for your edification, a few graphics, and I think importantly a lot of information about activities in the industry that we are aware of anyway over the last 12 months and what we might see coming up shortly in the future. So I think I often get questions like that, so I wanted to include this in a packet of information we give you. And also I have some DOG Bing for you that as I leave today, I'll hand out maps that include pictures of the North Slope and all of the units and who owns them. Same thing for the Cook Inlet. And then the activity maps, we call them, that ID different well exploration development projects that have occurred in each of the Cook Inlet and the North Slope. I'll pass this out for you. So I hope that when I come back in a few weeks, we'll see these maps all over the building. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, and thank you, Kevin. And we have questions now back on any of the material or other issues. Let's go through the material presented first, and then we'll go if people have other issues for Kevin. So Representative Munoz and then Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you. Industry projections show sharp decline after 2018. Does your own department have its own independent analysis of what that decline looks like in relation to what the industry is projecting?
Representative Munoz, through the chair, we publish each year an annual report that does have a forecast included in it. Up until about 8 years ago, we were drafting that somewhat independently of the Department of Revenue. More recently, we have participated with the Department of Revenue to try to match our forecast with theirs. So it's not an independent look in terms of what revenue has done. You should see some matching with that. I think revenue's forecast over the next few years, I think, is something like a slight uptick next year, and then a decline, a small decline after that, and then I think something like 6%, 5-6% thereafter through 2020. Now that's just I'm shooting averages off the top of my head. That assumes that certain activities will occur. Typically, when we were doing our own assessments and forecasts, we were a little cagey about what we would assume were pending development projects, and were only interested in those projects that had approved plans of development, say, for example. And so there was some variation in our forecast in the past and what DOR was doing. We may, you know, upon some internal evaluation, begin doing that again.
Just a follow-up on that question before we go to Representative Gardner. So the plans of development, so for CD5, ConocoPhillips, that has a plan of development. Is there a plan of development for Point Thompson? What do we have plans of development for? Are those in the either in these later charts or on the chart that you're passing out to us later?
Mr. Chairman, a plan of development is usually a list of activities proposed for the next year for a particular unit. For the Colville River unit, of which the CD5 is a part, we will see in that plan of development maybe a suggestion about how many wells may be drilled, what kind of data evaluation may be occurring, whether or not any kind of roads or expansion of surface facilities might be considered. A plan of development is a plan, and so as a consequence, some of those activities don't get done, or they're set off for a year, or there are some changes. But it usually is a way of guiding and having the state have an opportunity to review the direction of development within the unit. I would like to make sure you understand that we don't often see from the lessees any forecast of production that may occur as a consequence of implementing this plan. Our rules governing the kind of information that we can get from the producers is confined to data, not interpreted data. And their interpretation of their own potential is something that they don't often share with us. So we end up taking a look at what kinds of activities they're proposing. And to the extent that we do this internally, we may assign some potential to a plan of development. Doesn't happen very often, but that's the idea, is to give the state an opportunity to see into the planning strategies of a producer to make sure that they are proceeding in a prudent way to develop our resource.
So when somebody comes out and says that in a year they plan to have 10,000 barrels a day or 30,000 barrels a day or whatever that would be, that is communicated directly to, is that through revenue or is that the plan of development, or how does that, the numbers that have been coming forward as estimates,
correct.
Is that just our looking at, we think something should happen? Are those announcements by companies? Is that how is that generated?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that especially if it's material, a company has by law under SEC rules a requirement to report potential new reserves and new production, depending on the size of the company and the size of the addition. You'll often see those sorts of communications in the press. Typically, that is not what we're relying on when we're doing our work, and nor is it the same kind of information we may receive. A good deal of the discussion about the resource and the reserves that may be subject to production under a plan of development remains confidential between us and the producers. And as I said, more typically, it'll be more data in a more raw form than some estimate of or forecast of production over several years. So if you were to open up a decision with respect to an expansion of a unit, for example, or the approval of a plan of development, there'll be some discussion about whether it's meeting the criteria of a prudent activity as listed in our statute. And the application itself may have a fair amount of information from the applicant, the lessee who's proposing the plan of development. But there'll be considerable information that we will be dealing with that remains confidential.
Okay, thank you. Representative Gardner, and then Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. One is kind of quick, and the other is a more substantive question. Should I take them both now, or just one and then
sure.
Come on.
Go ahead.
Okay. The first one is on your slide on page 18, which has a fiscal year oil and gas revenue on state lands, and one of the elements, the purple one, is settlement income. Mm-hmm. Does that include income as a result of settlement of a tariff dispute?
Through the chair, Representative Gardner, yes, it could be. I mean, but it's more than that. First of all, I'll make a point on this. This is somewhat mistitled because it's not just, it's only royalty revenue
oh,
not
okay.
tax revenue.
Okay.
The oil and gas settlements were largely the in the early 90s were cash payments made to the state as a consequence of resolving the ANS royalty litigation that was initiated in 1977. Every now and then you'll see a tick here and there that's related to some readjustment of those royalty settlement agreements because, as you say, TAPS tariffs were changed and or the calculation of royalty value changed and had some retroactive impact on payment, and so the companies were obliged to give us a check.
Okay, thank you. The other question refers to page 3, and you talked about avoiding duplication of facilities. And some of us have heard from independents that getting access to an existing facility is an impediment mm-hmm. to developing and shipping oil and gas. Can you talk about some of the ways that we might, as policymakers, try to help that process along so that new explorers and independents can be confident of being able to actually produce their finds?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, in unitization, we're usually dealing with one set of owners, and those owners together participate in a unit agreement and agree to build a single facility. So that's in the main what I was referring to, is to limit the number of facilities associated with some field, single field. The question of facility access, as you've heard it and described it, is when someone else outside of a unit has made a discovery, wants to develop oil and gas, and has a choice to make. Do I have to build my own processing facilities, my own flow lines and pipelines, flow lines, I'll use that word, my own roads, or can I share the facilities that are already there that belong to someone else? The key feature is it belongs to someone else. And so we've seen in a couple of cases on the North Slope where that decision has gone both ways. When Ugarit was developed or is now in operation, a facility access agreement was achieved between Pioneer and the owners of the Kuparuk River Unit. And so oil, gas, and water is moved from the Ugarit field and the oil is separated from the water and the gas in the facilities at Kuparuk. And for a fee, that is a service that the Kuparuk River Unit provides to Ugarit. The agreement, of course, is confidential. It's thick, though. It's 200 pages long or thereabouts, and it has to deal with all kinds of issues. But there is an example of a company that was able to achieve some kind of commercial relationship with an existing facility. Right next door is the Nikaichuk unit, and the operator at Nikaichuk, Eni, the Italian oil company, elected to build their own processing facilities rather than try to strike a deal with another existing owner. And that must have been made on some calculation of the cost. Is there something we can do? We're working on that. We keep coming back and telling you that we're working on it, but it is a huge challenge. It seems to me, though, that in certain, maybe limited instances, we should be able to let our lessees, applicants for land use permits and so forth, that the permit they receive may be conditioned on some arrangements that could be made by others to use those facilities. Perhaps in permitting an ice road, for example, the department could consider that if another firm wanted to share the use of that ice road, that some arrangement can be made. Typically, those arrangements are made anyway. So Savant and Exxon shared a nice road out to Badami. So that those things happen. It's just a question of how deep the state needs to get into those discussions.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With your indulgence, I appreciate it. Through the chair, Kevin, your answer to Representative Gardner answers some of this, but there's been a lot of discussion about the relative competitiveness of Alaska's oil and gas industry. As a general question, and the issue of tax policy aside, are there any areas of operation for your division that you'd like to see changes in that you'd need legislative authorization for that might help improve Alaska's competitive status in the oil and gas industry? What would be your dream sheet?
My dream sheet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Sadler, part of this strategic planning effort that is still underway is looking at ways of doing things smarter, faster, better, and basically you hear about streamlining, but that's precisely the point. What are things that we do that can be done better? What are we missing somewhere along the way? So having said that, our folks are actively looking at making what we have work better. I can expect that as part of that process, we may very well have several ideas that we might share with you in terms of making things happen and solves problems that we see that may be coming up. And so I think the right answer is stay tuned. I think when the executive process is finished, we can come to you with ideas.
And thank you. And just to elaborate on that, I want to make sure that we extend to you, if it's not something that's rising to the level of the governor putting in a bill, but there are things that we can do to smooth the road for regulations or statutory changes that are necessary that makes the policy work better, makes the entire process work better. We encourage you to share those with us to the extent that you're able to. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of questions. One is that we've heard a whole lot about wells and less wells and right now, and I'm wondering what of the wells that have been proposed or that haven't happened didn't happen because of either state permitting, federal permitting, environmental lawsuit. What of the wells that are not proceeding are proceeding that you know of for reasons other than financial consideration? Do we have a list of that? You may not have them off the top of your head, but is there some place where we can go to see? I mean, we know CD5, ConocoPhillips, and that development is on hold because of a bridge. I'm not sure what the status is at Point Thompson, we've heard a number of things. We've heard from, and of course that was at the oil and gas. Ken Thompson from Brooks Range was saying that if they could have gotten their credits back in a year, they would have drilled another exploratory well. They have to wait until next year because it's a cash flow kind of thing. So that's in economics. But I'm wondering about the other ones that are prevented by other kind of regulatory hurdles that are not economic. Is there some place that we can go to kind of get an analysis of that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll struggle with the answer to that question because I don't think there is such a list or an inventory. You've isolated the question to activities that have not been reported in the press, I suppose, that refer to failure to gain access to a certain area or for some other kinds of technical challenges a well wasn't drilled. And I find that rather difficult to answer.
Well, no, I want to interrupt because that's not what I'm asking for. I mean, we just over the course of a year to go to the press and try and pull out these pieces. I'm not asking for confidential information. I mean, we have BP not doing their wells that were planned because they're, at least in the press, reported engineering reestimate and reestimate of whether the drill rig or blowout preventer or whatever. They want to make sure that they have adequate engineering design. We've kind of seen that in the press. But is there some place where the state has put together those things so that it says that are publicly reported, or is there any place that we can go to say, well, these 3, 4, 5 developments, I mean, I've named three or four right here, but I don't know, you know, we only can keep track of so many pieces. We're on all these different committees and everything else, and I'm wondering whether the state has any place where it puts together, you know, we've got 4 wells here that aren't being drilled because of there's an environmental lawsuit, or we've got, like I say, those different aspects. Is there anywhere that that's put together so that we can kind of get a handle on wells not being drilled for reasons other than economics?
Mr. Chairman, the answer simply is no, not in the Division of Oil and Gas, where we might have some attention to that. We redraft these activity maps every 4 or 5 months as things change. So we do try to keep track of the same kinds of press articles that you're referring to, and to get a handle on activities. We keep our ear to the ground. We know what kinds of permits that are coming through, permit applications are coming through the door, and that informs what we publish here. And in some cases, we speak to what may or could happen in the future, but we don't really keep an inventory of projects that have failed. It's the kind of, I think I'd be willing to offer to assemble a list like that, but I bet you've hit most of the ones that we know of as well, in terms of CD5, projects that, you know, have been prevented because of some permitting issue or that sort of thing. Well, we'd go to the same places that you would to find that answer.
Okay. Well, I think we'd appreciate that if you can help us with that, because that's information that, you know, we just get conflicting testimony, and it would be good if we knew when you're updating and removing things from your maps, if you have reasons that are non-confidential, that you can let us know just in a simple chart form. That would be very helpful to us as well to go with the chart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I wrote it down, it occurs to me we're being asked to, you know, when the dogs didn't bark, I guess.
Yeah. Well, it's when you take the dogs off of your charts. I guess the other thing is we just received a, and of course this was from Revenue, the Oil and Gas Production Tax Status Report to the Legislature in January 18th. And on there's, and though that's not your division, it's like chart 5 is giving capital expenditures and from the currently producing units and those under development. And there's a number of those things in there. Have you reviewed this, and does this jive with the information that you have so that, or do you have conflicts with the data that was produced in the revenue report?
Mr. Chairman, I haven't reviewed that report. I do know that the Department of Revenue, because of the information sharing that we are now permitted to do with respect to taxes, is party to discussions of plans of development and that sort of thing. We don't receive, as a routine basis in Department of Natural Resources, anything with respect to costs, as they do. And their interest in our plans of development is usually driven by the fact that they want to be able to predict how much, say, tax credits may be required in working up a forecast of tax revenues. So they do participate at some level in the information that we're collecting in plans of development, that sort of thing. So that it's informed, I'm based on the characterization of that graphic that you're speaking to, it sounds like that information has been informed by information that we've shared with the Department of Revenue.
Okay, thank you. Are there other questions around the table for pieces that are not currently on the in the presentation? Well, thank you, Kevin. If you're going to be around, that'd be great, because we might, if Kathy's done, if anybody has, or Kathy, Alaska Oil and Gas Commission is up before us, if there's some coordinating questions that we have, we might ask you to come back up at the end.
So I will do that, sir.
Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Ms. Forrester, are you online?
Yes, sir, I am.
Great. I guess hope you've been able to listen or watch our presentation so far. And we have a packet in our, actually we have two. We have a book, 50 Years of Service to Alaska, and then we have a presentation which is dated January 21 before us. And I think that, do we have that as, no, we don't, do we have that as a PowerPoint? No, and we do not have that as a PowerPoint, but we do all have that on the table before us. So if you'd like to go through your presentation, that's great. And if you're using the PowerPoints, if you, when you switch pages, if you could just tell us which page number you're going to make sure everybody's aligned. Thank you, Kathy.
Certainly.
Go ahead and identify yourself and your agency for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Kathy Forrester. I'm the Engineering Commissioner for the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Chairman Seaton and members of the House Resources Committee, Commission Chair Seamount had planned to be in Juneau today and was looking forward to coming before your committee. Unfortunately, he became ill earlier in the week. In fact, he spent a few days in the hospital, and he's having difficulty speaking due to some upper respiratory issues. So he's asked me to pinch it for him and to extend his apologies for not being able to speak with you in person today.
Well, thank you. And if you do talk to him, extend to him our hope that he gets better soon and we have an opportunity in the future to talk with him.
I'll do that. And for the record, I think he just needs to pay attention to his doctor better. That's a woman nagging here. All right, back to the presentation. The first page is simply an identifier so that, you know, when you get put this in your pile of all the things you get from all the different people you listen to, you can remember who this was for. What I'm going to talk to you today about are, first, who we are and what we do. Then I'm going to share some activity trend information with you. I won't spend a lot of time talking about it, but it'll be stuff that you and your staff might find interesting and insightful. And then I'm going to talk about some of the hot topics, the issues that are before our commission currently. That so we can go on to page four. That's a summary of the AOGCC staffing. We have three commissioners. One is required by statute to be a petroleum engineer, and that's me. One is required by statute to be a petroleum geologist, and that's our current chair, Dan Seamount. The third is a public member who is required to have relevant oil and gas training and or experience, and that's John Norman, and he has many years of experience as an oil and gas attorney. Our staff also consists of five petroleum engineers, two petroleum geologists, six field inspectors, and assorted IT admin, clerical, and data management staff. Moving to page five, the AOGCC's mission, as set out in the statutes, is to prevent hydrocarbon waste, to protect correlative rights, to promote greater ultimate hydrocarbon recovery, to protect fresh groundwater from damage caused by oil and gas operations, and to promote human safety in those areas above where we have jurisdiction. So, again, as Mr. Banks said, our roles are very different. His group acts as the landowner for the state and landlord for the state, and we act kind of as the police department for making sure that on all lands throughout the state, not just state-owned lands, that oil and gas operations are being conducted using good oil field practices in a way that nobody's going to get hurt, and that the hydrocarbons are going to be recovered safely, efficiently, effectively, and without doing any damage to the fresh groundwaters that they have to pass through with the wells to get to the resource. Moving to page six, our jurisdiction is over oil and gas resource development, geothermal resource development, underground storage of natural gas, and metering accuracy for custody transfer. Now that's only, you know, for when oil or gas changes ownership. That's so that we can ensure that the guy who says he's selling you 10 barrels of oil is selling you 10 barrels of oil. Moving to page seven, we approve a number of operations. Typically, we approve the drilling of oil, gas, and geothermal wells and service wells for oil, gas, and geothermal operations. We also approved sundry various work that's done on wells that have already been drilled. We approved underground injection. That could be for enhanced oil recovery. It could be for disposal of oil field waste, or it could be for gas storage. We also approve what we refer to as conservation orders, and those are the special rules by which a particular field will operate. You know, we have a set of regulations that govern statewide operations, but sometimes there need to be special rules for a particular field, and those are couched in a conservation order. And we have miscellaneous other approvals that we give. For example, we give permission to use multi-phase meters instead of the more rigorously accurate meters if it's not for custody transfer, or if it or if a custody transfer agreement has been worked out between the two parties. Okay, so that's enough on that. Moving to the slot to page eight, that's the title page, activity trends. Page nine is very busy, but what it shows is the number of operators involved in drilling. And it's I hope you guys have a color copy, because the colors are what make the message. If you look in the earlier years, the bars were dotted by red and green, and red and green are ConocoPhillips and BP. And so in many of the early years, most of the exploratory drilling was done by ConocoPhillips and BP. And now if you look into the more recent years, we've got quite a rainbow. We've got several operators besides those two. In fact, in the last few years, there's not any of the dark green anymore. But, you know, that's good news and bad news. Although BP hasn't been exploring in the last few years and Conoco's exploration has decreased, we've had quite a few new operators come in and fill those holes. So that's the good news. And that's really all I want to say about that. But if you have need for any additional information, your staffs or folk are certainly welcome to give us a call, and we'll help you out in whatever way we can. Moving on to page 10, it's the same sort of thing, information, but instead of for exploratory wells, it's for development in service wells. And, you know, because Kuparuk and Prudhoe Bay are the biggest fields, and both BP and Conoco are doing infill drilling in those fields, you know, those fields and those operators dominate the development and service drilling activity in the state. And again, that's all I'm going to say, but your folks can give us a call if they need more information. Moving to slide page 11, this is just to show that what the activity's been looking like in terms of number of permits to drill that we give, number of reservoirs that we have in the state, number of active wells, and what has triggered some of the bumps that have come along the way. Again, just for your information and your use later. Page 12 just lists the hot topic items that I'm going to talk to you about. So you can flip on to page 13. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Just an explanation on page 11.
Yeah. Okay.
You said there was some explanations of the bumps in the road or something that came along, and I'm not seeing that on.
So the yellow arrows say Cook Inlet. This is when Cook Inlet was being developed. And then the next one will say this is when Prudhoe Bay and Kaparik were being developed. And then the next one says this is when the exploration and satellite developments were coming on.
Okay.
So that's what I meant by the explanations of the bumps.
Okay, thank you. And Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And what is the hot pink squares and the triangles and the
name? Okay. Representative Gardner, through the chair, the purple line is number of permits. The hot pink line is number of reservoirs. The green line is number of active wells. Did that
answer your question?
Yes. And by number of permits, that's application for permits, or that's you've issued that number of permits?
That's the number of permits to drill that we've issued that year.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Page 13. I'm just briefly going to hit on North Slope gas sale, because our role, although it's important, it's very minor. Going back to our mission, our job is to prevent hydrocarbon waste and to ensure greater ultimate recovery of hydrocarbons, and that means both oil and gas. And as some of you are tired of hearing me say, anytime you take gas from an oil reservoir that hasn't finished producing its oil, you put that oil, the remaining oil, at risk of all or part of it being lost by the extraction of the gas. So we have completed a study on the impacts of natural gas sales at the Prudhoe Bay field on the oil recovery, and that study is sitting on the shelf waiting to be used, but it will need some minor updating. As you know, because it's getting a little dust on it now. We are engaged in a Point Thompson study because Point Thompson is, by definition, you know, by the state of Alaska's definition, an oil reservoir. And again, when you take gas from Point Thompson, if all the oil hasn't been extracted, you put some of that oil will be at risk. We're nearing completion on the Point Thompson study, and we will use both of those studies in determining what kind of offtake allowable we give to both of those fields. Offtake allowable is how much gas can you sell per day, or how much can you produce per day and not reinject. So we have one study completed and sitting on the shelf, one study nearing completion. And we wanted to conduct these studies and get them ready before we had a request before us, so that nobody would be waiting on us, so that we could make our decisions based on a good scientific analysis, and we wouldn't have to say, oh, we'll get back to you, you know, when everybody is tapping their fingers and chomping at the bit, ready to go. We don't want to be the bottleneck in the process.
Okay, thank you. And a couple of questions on this. Those studies, are those confidential, or are those publicly available, or when it's complete, the second one, but are those publicly available, or are those confidential?
Representative Seaton, the Prudhoe Bay study has been completed, and a publicly available summary is available. However, on both of those studies, we signed confidentiality agreements with the operator, and on the Prudhoe Bay study, part of it is still confidential, and on the Point Thompson study, nothing is publicly available yet.
Okay, and for that public summary, is that on a website, or does the committee need to request you to send us a copy of that?
I think it's available on our website, but when we're done, I'm going to make myself a note. If it's not on our website, I will see that it gets there and see that a copy gets sent to everyone on the committee.
Thank you very much. And Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you. Kathy, we have new members on the committee, and maybe they know this already, but when I started, I didn't. Can you go into a little bit of a little bit more detail of why there's concern about taking too much gas down a pipeline and, because there's still some oil left? Can you just kind of go into that for the new ones here?
Certainly. Through the chair, when the gas that's in an oil reservoir serves a few purposes. One, it maintains reservoir pressure, and that pressure is what pushes the oil up through the ground, through the pipe, to the surface. If you produce the gas, you deplete the pressure. And as you deplete the pressure, you deplete the energy that pushes that oil up. And so you get to a point where the oil can't come out of the ground anymore. That's one of the ways that the gas is used. Another way the gas is used is as enhanced oil recovery fluid. And so a lot of the gas that is produced with the oil is reinjected just to maintain the pressure, but some of it is reinjected into the oil portion of the reservoir to help enhance the oil's recovery. And if you start selling the gas, you're not going to be using it to help get the oil out of the rock. And some of the gas is even exported to other fields. Some of the gas from Prudhoe Bay is exported to other fields to help them with their production. They use the gas for enhanced oil recovery and pressure maintenance. So the gas at Prudhoe Bay is not only being used to help get more oil out of the ground at Prudhoe Bay, but it's also being used to get oil out of the ground at other fields on the North Slope. Now, for Point Thompson, it's a little bit different. Point Thompson is what we call a condensate reservoir. And in the reservoir, all of the in the Thompson Reservoir, there's a 100 to 200 foot thick oil rim at the bottom. It's just like a regular oil reservoir. You deplete the gas cap, you deplete the pressure, you lose the energy. But the bulk of the Thompson Reservoir is a gas condensate reservoir, and in the reservoir, everything acts as a dense phase fluid. It's not really a gas, it's not really an oil because of the temperatures and pressures. It's just something kind of funky. But when you produce the gas condensate mush that's in there, and when it drops in pressure, condensate falls out. And when they produce the first Point Thompson well, they're going to get gas and liquid. And in the reservoir, the same thing happens. As the pressure drops, the liquids drop out. So as you produce, you're going to drop the pressure in the reservoir. And what will happen is liquids will fall out. And when those liquids fall out in the reservoir, two bad things will happen. They'll stick to the walls of the rock, and to the little rock sand grains, and a large portion of them will never be recoverable. And where they'll drop out is where the pressure drop is greatest, and that's near the wellbore, which means that they can also act to diminish the amount of gas that's produced. So producing the Point Thompson Reservoir as a gas reservoir initially may be problematic, not only from loss of reserves, but also from loss of productivity of the wells. That was a whole lot, but a short answer that probably would have been kinder to everyone is that there's some explanations of the Prudhoe phenomena and the Point Thompson phenomena on our website. and they're called ALGCC's role in setting a gas offtake allowable at Point Thompson at Prudhoe, something like that. But those are easily available on our website, and they'll do a much better job of giving you time to absorb this information than I just did.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
Was that terribly painful for everyone?
No, that was good. We liked the mush. I don't think we would have gotten that out of the – I think that's probably a better explanation than is on the website.
Okay.
I did have a question, and that is where it says ensure greater ultimate recovery of hydrocarbons. And the measurement of hydrocarbons, is that by BTUs or is that by dollars?
We don't do anything based on finances at the ALGCC. We do it based on volume, physics. So we would use BTUs.
Okay, great. That's what we want to know. Thanks.
All right, I'm going to flip the page to page 14. And, gas storage has been going on in the state for a number of years, but some of you are probably more familiar with some of the recent activity. But ALGCC's role in gas storage is, again, to ensure that no hydrocarbon is wasted. In other words, so that when an operator injects gas, they inject it into a place that will give it back. And the second role is to ensure safe operations, and that's so that the injection is done in a way that the gas doesn't migrate someplace where it's going to come back out somewhere where you weren't anticipating it and cause an explosion. That's kind of an easy way to describe what we do. There are 7 storage injection orders in existence in the Cook Inlet, and I've listed those for you. And, Prudhoe Bay is a big gas storage project because a lot of 7 or 8 BCF a day is reinjected into the Prudhoe Bay Reservoir. So the one that is probably getting the most attention right now is the request to store gas that CINGSA has made recently. And we have issued them as a storage injection order, but someone has opposed that and requested that we reconsider that order. And so since it's under reconsideration, I can't talk about it in any more detail other than just general public knowledge questions.
Sure.
So, okay. I'm going to flip the page to page 15.
Before you do that, Representative Gardner had a question.
Thank you.
Okay.
You comment that Prudhoe Bay is a big gas storage unit, in effect. And so my question is, will the gas that's been reinjected over the past 30 years to keep up the pressure, is that ultimately recoverable?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, yes, it will be.
Thank you.
That's what we're counting on. Okay, I'm going to take a deep breath. If there aren't any other questions, I'll flip the page to page 15.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Recently, there's been some non-traditional drilling under AOGCC jurisdiction. A few years back before I got here, there was a flurry of activity around coal bed methane, and There is no current activity in that area, but were there to be, that would be under AOGCC jurisdiction. And there has been some recent activity in the area of geothermal. And as of July of last year, geothermal drilling and operations transferred from the DNR's authority to our authority. And the activity that we've seen has been by NACNEC Electric, by Ormat in the Mount Spur area, and in the Akutan area. But there is no activity right now in geothermal. And there was also some activity in the area of the Pilgrim Springs, but that doesn't fall under our jurisdiction because it isn't for commercial use. And there are a couple of other – there are some criteria that make geothermal fall under our jurisdiction or not, and that one didn't fall under our jurisdiction.
So, Kathy, the ground source heat pumps or ocean heat pump, like in Seward at the Sea Life Center, the ocean source, or the Juneau Airport here with the ground source heat pumps heating the airport, those do not fall under your jurisdiction? Is that what I'm hearing?
I think that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And those are already existing operations, aren't they?
Oh, they are now, yes. They've just recently come online.
Yeah.
And Representative Foster has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the jurisdiction of the Pilgrim Geothermal, where would that fall under then?
I think that would be DNR.
Thank you.
I think it's DNR.
We'll forward that question to them and find out where that is.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry, I didn't know.
No, that's fine, Kathy. We appreciate getting that question on the table. So go ahead.
Okay, I'm going to turn the page to page 16. Now, when somebody drills something that isn't under our jurisdiction, if it could have the same kinds of risks that an oil and gas well has, then there is a clause in AS 31 that allows us to take jurisdiction, and that's all that's on this page. When the commission finds sufficient likelihood of an unexpected encounter of oil, gas, or other hazardous substance, we may designate the area subject to our regulations and assert jurisdiction. And that's what we did with the NACNEC well, because it started, that activity was going on before July of 2010, and we did that because that well was drilled on the edge of an oil and gas basin, and in fact, I think it was 11 of the 13 nearest wells had all encountered shows of oil and gas, and there was no scientific data or evidence to conclusively prove to us that they knew they weren't going to encounter any oil or gas. So we asserted jurisdiction over the NACNEC well before geothermal authority had been given to us, just to make sure that the appropriate safeguards were used, right kind of drilling mud and the right kind of blowout prevention equipment. And we did that again last year. If you turn the page, I'm sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. If you turn to page 17, we did that on the NACNEC electric before July of 2010, but we also did that with Ceres underground coal gasification project they had last year. And the first four of their wells, they drilled without any encounters or any encounters where they needed to use their blowout prevention equipment, but their fifth well took a kick, and they did have to use their blowout prevention equipment, and they eventually had to abandon the well because they couldn't regain control over it. So that's an example of us asserting jurisdiction and everybody not knowing that it was really a good thing that we did, because I don't think any of us would have wanted to have had a blowout in the Cook Inlet because Siri was trying to do good things. So I'm just apologizing for myself here. People don't like it when we assert jurisdiction, but we do it for a reason, and the underground coal gasification is an example of where it's a darn good thing that we did. So I'm going to flip to page 18. Speaking of blowouts, of course, the Gulf of Mexico disaster was a terrible thing, and when it was hot, cold front and center in the media, we got a whole lot of inquiries from local, national, and international sources, and we spent a lot of time here at the AOGCC responding to all of those and educating people on what we do and you know, what we knew about what was going on. We have been watching all of the various studies that have been performed on that incident and reviewing the findings and looking to see, you know, if there's any learnings from those findings that we need to apply to our way of regulating and our operations here in this state, as I'm sure all the operators have been doing. And based on some of the early findings, we've already begun an effort to recruit additional field inspectors, and we recently hired our sixth one, and we're hoping to get a seventh one later this year, and also add a petroleum engineer for better oversight of the complicated operations that we have to regulate over. We are reviewing all of our regulations and statutes based on the things that we're seeing. We feel like we've got good regulations and statutes, but, you know, we need to do everything we can to make sure that don't have any gaps. We have a docket set to hold a public hearing when we get all the results of all the studies in. We'll probably have that hearing sometime late this spring. And based on what comes out from all of our review and all of the input we get in that hearing, we may end up adopting or amending our regulations and statutes if we identify the need to do so. I'm going to flip to page 19. Liberty has some of the characteristics similar to the Gulf of Mexico ultra deep well. It will be a very, very, very highly extended reach drilling operation, and we intend to apply more stringent oversight than normal because of those similarities. Page 20. We recently updated our regulations surrounding suspended wells because the language wasn't clear enough for an operator to understand what we intended. I'll give you an example. An operator is required to report to us the status of the well every 5 years, and what we intended with that was that they go out and check on the well and make sure that it was still sealed off, still safe, still mechanical, you know, still contained, had mechanical integrity. But some of the operators, the report would be, yep, still on our list. So we clarified the language and so that operators really understood what was expected of them. There has been a big push this year to identify and address suspended wells that aren't on active pads and platforms, but the vast majority of the suspended wells in the state are on active wells and platforms that are visited frequently by the operator. So those really don't pose a problem to us. But the biggest area of concern to us, there are over 100 wells on BLM-managed lands that in the NPRA primarily, and those wells aren't in compliance with our regulations. They're not even in compliance with BLM's regulations. And unfortunately for us, although we have jurisdiction over those lands, it's hard to assert authority over the federal government when you're the state government. So we're working really hard trying to figure out what we can do to get the BLM to follow their own rules in our state. If you noted unhappiness in my voice, you were very perceptive. I'm going to turn the page to...
Before you do that...
Ask me some questions.
Before we do that, that is for questions. On the suspended wells, now are those counting... I know as a past commercial fisherman in Cook Inlet, we're drifting around and off the shore in Cook Inlet. There's a number of marked, you know, abandoned well kind of things. Are those also in compliance, or were those abandoned in a way that doesn't require inspection, or what's the, you know, what's the deal with those?
If a well has been properly plugged and abandoned according to our regulations, then it doesn't require monitoring, and it is 100% safe.
So the question is, in Cook Inlet off the shore of, down, say, Starisky Creek, and there where there were some offshore wells shown on the charts, are those, do we have information that all of those are properly plugged and abandoned?
I'm not familiar with those wells, so my gut is that they're properly plugged and abandoned, because I've looked at every single well in this state that's not properly plugged and abandoned, and none in Cook Inlet come to mind. So I guess the answer to your question is, yes, those are properly plugged and abandoned, because if they weren't, they'd be on my you-know-what list.
Okay, good. And we'll go to questions. Anyone? Reverend Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned the Liberty. I'm just curious, the what depth are we looking at for the Liberty well there, and comparing that to what the depth is for the Gulf of Mexico, and what's considered a shallow well?
Well, the problem with the Liberty well isn't so much its depth as it is its horizontal reach. It's going out 8 or more miles horizontally, and that's the problem. The Gulf of Mexico, the problem with the Gulf of Mexico was, one of the problems with the Gulf of Mexico well wasn't so much its depth as it was the depth of the water that it was in. It was in, oh gee, thousands of 5,000 feet of water. Nice. And so before you even start to drill into dirt, you got to travel through 5,000 feet of water. And so because of that, the blowout preventer for that well was on the seafloor. That will not be the case with Liberty. In fact, the blowout preventers for the Liberty wells will be on the Endicott Island. And so that's a big difference. But the similarity is in the distance they have to drill, and it's more of a horizontal distance.
Thank you.
Kathy, a question back on slide 5. You had protect underground freshwater from damage caused by oil and gas operations. My understanding is that some of the fracking technologies that have allowed the shale gas production were actually, some of those were developed or enhanced or used up here, and we have a lot of lateral drilling up on the North Slope. Is that using that same kind of technology, fracking technology, and do we have any regulations, or do we have any monitoring or reporting of the fluids or any of these things that we keep seeing in the news as, you know, Pennsylvania and New York are kind of doing emergency regulations to cover things? Do we have any thing that covers those same issues on our wells here in Alaska?
Representative Seaton, the short answer is yes, but there's a much longer answer. Hydraulic fracturing is a technology that's been used on hundreds of thousands of wells around the world for over 75 years, and safely. And the key is you drill the well properly, you case it and cement it properly, and then you run your tubulars properly so that you have good mechanical integrity. And then when you do your hydraulic frack, the fluids that you pump stay in the zone that you injected them into. And then when you produce your well back, when you're bringing your fluids out to your site to frack them, you transport them safely. And then when you're when you're flowing back your fluids, you handle them equally safely. If you do all of those things, hydraulic fracturing is a very safe operation. And if you don't do those things right, then that's when you get into trouble. The other thing is that some of what has been reported in the shale development is more political than factual, more sensational than rational. When you are drilling through, so these shales are wet, and they have, you know, when you have water and gas together, then and the water's not very saline. Some of that water is going to be used by Farmer Jones for his well, and if there's already gas in it and his sink catches fire, that's nature. That's not because of the fracturing job that happened. So you have to dig into the details on a case-by-case basis of a fractured well incident to understand whether it was nature or whether, you know, and it's possible that if they're pumping into the same reservoir and all of the operators' wells have been drilled and cased safely, but Farmer Jones's well was not done very well, that the migration could be his well. So it's a real complicated issue, but there has never been an underground problem with groundwater associated with fracturing that can be proven scientifically in the 70 years that they've been doing them and monitoring them. So I don't know if I helped you.
Yeah, and Kathy, I'm just trying to get the explanation of, on the North Slope where we have permafrost, we're probably not talking about water continuity between the surface and those layers anyway, are we? Or do we have situations where the existing wells that are going down might not be cemented through impervious layers? We don't have any of that problem up here, is that correct?
Representative Seaton, no, we do not.
Okay. One other question. We've heard, we're disappointed that some things are going slowly. One thing that was somewhat of a concern was that there's been publicly announced anyway that Shell's platform drilling operation was, is much shallower than the Gulf of Mexico, so it wasn't problematic that way, and that there was kind of analysis that Prudhoe Bay is a lower pressure system, so that Shell, being offshore was related to a low pressure system, and I'm just trying to figure out whether we have data like that, because Point Thompson, as I understand it, is a very high-pressure system. And do you have information on the potential of, or what's being required in the offshore for blowout preventers and those kind of things that we can understand which kind of field that Shell would be drilling in and the expected pressures, or can you just kind of explain that to us here?
Okay. You can always be surprised, so your equipment should be adequate to address the surprises. And I'm sure that the BOE MRE, which will be regulating Shell's development, will require a large safety factor in the blowout prevention equipment and the tubulars, but the Shell development is expected to be normally pressured. And yes, we do have lots of geologic data on trends as to where geopressured reservoirs exist and where normally pressured reservoirs should be expected. And based on the data that we have, shale exploration should be in a normally pressured reservoir. However, the BOEMRE, which used to be the MMS, I'm sure will be requiring adequate safety factors on the blowout prevention equipment so that if they get a surprise and they get some abnormal pressures, they'll be able to cope with them.
Okay, and do you have any input with the new federal agency there, or the renamed federal agency, on those kind of well operations and well design features, or is that totally a federal area, or does our OCS through the consistency review engage you as well?
We have no jurisdiction in the federal waters, but we won't be shy about asking to look at what they want to do and offering our input. They can tell us to go pound sand if they want to, but we won't be shy about offering input if we feel it's needed. I think, you know, we don't have jurisdiction, we definitely have a strong interest in making sure that it's done right.
Okay, thanks, Ed. And I guess one other question on Cook Inlet. I know, I can't remember if it was 63 or 83, there was a blowout that went for 13 months in Cook Inlet, and big flame coming out of there for a long period of time. The renewed drilling, is there anything and concern or about the availability of a rig for drilling relief wells like the Gulf of Mexico? I mean, we were very lucky there in that Cook Inlet because it was a all-gas well, and it wasn't oil, but it went for 13 months before they could get a rig in to drill a relief well. So is your agency concerned with that at all, or is that somebody else's bailiwick?
That would be our bailiwick, and in that public hearing we're going to have sometime this spring, that will be one of the items that we'll be addressing, is because we're reviewing all of our offshore regulations and requirements. So we will be – that's going to be one of the primary questions we have to answer, is do we need to have two jackups in the inlet in order to allow one of them to be drilling?
Okay, thank you. Does anyone else have any other questions for Ms. Forrester? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kathy, on page 14, there's just some acronyms that I don't know what it is. SINGSA? What's that stand for?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, I apologize. SINGSA is Cook Inlet Natural Gas Storage, and I don't know what the A is, authority?
Okay. Thank you.
And my understanding is that's a wholly owned subsidiary of the parent company or of NSTAR, one of the two. So it's a third-party kind of storage facility, and the others are single producer storage permits.
That's correct.
Does anyone else have any questions for Mr. Banks? We have him in the audience here, or Kevin, is there anything that you want to clarify in the relationship of you and Ms. Forrester while she's on the line?
Yeah, I think she's probably capable of doing herself.
Yeah, I just, Representative Wilson has a question for you. Come back up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin, on page 18, it shows the fiscal year oil and gas royalty revenues on state lands. And then, it looks like since 2002, there haven't been any at all. Is that because of tax rebates, or not rebates?
Any settlements.
Well, I just, we haven't gotten Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, I got it now. That's just so that, because there hasn't been any lawsuits that we've won since then.
That is correct, through the chair, Representative Wilson. And again, these are royalty revenues. This doesn't include tax revenues. My apologies for the mislabeling.
Okay. Thank you.
Anyone else have anything for Mr. Banks? Well, we're making up for last time running over, and thanks for DNR coming in, and we appreciate that, and we will be adjourned at 2:50.
We didn't get our masks.